Zeisler. Yes. Go Cardinal. Had a baby. So, is this on? Yeah, working? Good. So, Matt, I'm not going to forget you comparing the high school room, upper room at PBC to the Space Needle. I think, you know, every time I go in there, you can see the whole city from here. I thought that was fantastic. Thank you, Matthew. He's crazy, that Matt Poole. Well, I had a fun experience this morning singing next to Elsie Soderbergh, and I just want to recommend that if you get a chance to just make you sing better. She's got a beautiful voice, her heart's in it, and it just helps me to sing, to, you know, stand next to her. So well done, Els. Thanks for that. And we're at a, I guess I got to stand off the side slightly, don't I? We're making our way through the book of Acts here on Sunday morning, and we are at a cliffhanger moment. If you were here last week, you'll realize that our breath has been held for an entire 7 days. What will happen to our hero? Paul was taken into custody, into Roman custody, in the midst of mob violence, and mob violence directed at him in particular. The Romans grabbed him, took him into protective custody, but this is going to be the beginning of 2 years incarceration for him. These are familiar to Paul, mob violence, incarceration by the Romans. This is not new to him. The mob had become dangerous, and what the Romans hated above all else in the empire was, let me move this ahead one. Is this going to do it? Yeah. What the Romans hated above all else was anything that went out of control. Mobs, insurrections, public demonstrations of any kind. They put up with a lot of graft and corruption and a whole bunch of things. But mobs were, they were death on, because they obviously feared some overthrow of their power. So once trouble started, the Roman soldiers stepped in. They grabbed Paul, and now he's in their control and will stay for some time. But at a, sort of a crucial moment, as the mob's there and the Romans are there, Paul turned to the guy in charge and said, "May I speak to them?" And he spoke to the Roman soldier in Greek, because that was the language that Roman soldiers used throughout their empire. It was the language of everybody. And the guy was, "Oh, wait, you're not the person we thought you were." And he was kind of interested. And that's where we left off last week. Paul, you know, grabbed by Romans. What will happen? And now we'll pick it up in chapter 22 of Acts this week. And what is great about this to me is we get to hear Paul tell his story in his own voice. And what I love about recovery ministry in general, it happens here, it happens Friday nights, it happens everywhere around the world, I think, in recovery settings, is a tremendous amount of the work of God happens when someone tells their story. When someone is able to say, "This is what happened to me. God stepped into my life in this way. Here's where I was. Here's where I am. God has done something for me." And Paul was the most extraordinary theological genius who's ever lived. He knew more and understood more and had plumbed the depths of God, of the mind and of God more than anyone else. But under this critical moment of threat and so on, we'll talk a bit about it, more about it in a sec, what he did was tell his story. And I want to kind of make the case for all of us that we, however far along we are, however articulate we are, however smart we are or taught we are, in some cases doesn't always matter as much as being able to give other people an account of what God has done for us, to be authentic witnesses to God in our own lives. And that's what we're about to run into. Well, I mentioned Paul was familiar with Roman custody and was familiar with mob violence. This occasion in Acts 21 is, by my count, the ninth time in the book of Acts that he's been set upon by some mob, and often leading to some kind of either being run out of town or arrested or something. And he's sort of an equal opportunity insulter in some way. He creates mobs for different, he made idolaters mad, he made Jews mad, he made unrighteous business folks mad, he made the Romans mad. The message that he proclaimed challenged everything. So wherever there was kind of humanity exalting itself, the gospel attacked that. And so it ticked people off over and over again. He would issue some challenge to the status quo, and people felt threatened by it, and they reacted to it, often, sometimes believing, but often along with belief went opposition. So this is the ninth time. And this one, however, as we know from last week, is somewhat different. The reason the mob set upon him this time was not because of anything he said. It wasn't because he issued a challenge. He was doing his level best to be low profile. He was trying to honor his heritage as a Jew. He had gone back to his hometown. He was trying to do everything he could to honor that, the fact that he was raised as a Jew, and that he honored his people, he honored his heritage. And enemies from somewhere else came and told lies about him. They said that he had defiled the temple in his actions, and it wasn't true. So this is the only time in Paul's history where he got busted for something he didn't do, effectively, where he didn't do the very thing he was being talked about. It was enemies who trumped up the charges, who fabricated things, and then he was set upon by a mob. And it's a moment when he realizes the best thing he can do now is tell his own story. I was trying to think of an analogy to this. It might be like, let's say this afternoon, you decide to go visit your uncle in San Francisco in North Beach. And you're kind of making your way through San Francisco, and all of a sudden, there's all these people everywhere, dressed in funny clothes, parading around, doing all, you know, these massive crowds everywhere. But you're just trying to go visit your uncle, perfectly innocent, have nothing in mind other than a visit to the city. And someone says, hey, you're one of those Westboro Baptist folks, aren't you? You're one of those crazy Christians that hates gays. You're one of those folks that are trying to ruin the lives of people we love. And all of a sudden, the mob crowds around you and are being abrasive and confronting. And you didn't do anything. You had no intention to talk to anybody. You weren't there to send a message to anyone. You're just trying to visit your uncle. But now you're confronted with a crowd of people who think they know you, and they don't, who assume things about you that aren't true. And it's not a good time to say, let me explain to you a nuanced version of God's will for the mystery of human sexuality. It's not a moment for that discussion to happen. And Paul kind of realizes that. He's being accused of something he didn't do. He's being accused of believing and having convictions that are misguided, of doing something he would never do, take a Gentile into the temple and so on. And so there he is, and what he's left with is his own story. And that's a good thing. And that's kind of where we are now. Luke has already told Paul's story himself. Luke, the historian, in chapter 9, told the story of what happened to Paul. But this is the first time. There'll be another one later, but this is the first time where Paul's telling it in his own voice. Here's what happened to me. Brethren, and fathers, hear the defense which I now make before you. And when they heard that he addressed them in the Hebrew language, they became quiet. Now, why is it important? What do you think's going on here, the fact that he addressed them in Hebrew? Just the last paragraph, he spoke Greek to the guard, because the guard knew Greek. Now he's speaking to Jews, whose base language is first language is Hebrew or some form of Hebrew. So he's addressing them in that language. And he speaks with an honorific to start with. Brethren and fathers. Not get your hands off me. Not some pushback against the threat that's come at him. He speaks to them as brethren and fathers. He speaks respectfully of the folks who are in his face, and he speaks to them in a language that they're likely to want to hear something in. What's going on here? What do we make of that? Why would he tell us, why is this true, and what's he doing? What's he thinking? Rick? Sure. Yeah, even though he's being threatened, he's not distancing himself from them, and he's wanting them to understand, isn't he? He's not saying that they have to cross into his territory in order to to hear what he has to say. He's willing to extend himself towards them. What is it like to use the language of the people you're trying to speak to? Can any of you think of an example where you've chosen, in a good sense, to use the language of your hearer? Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of slogans and a lot of things that we talk about that are common.
Right. That's a great example to me. Like, the 12-step world has a language that they know. I am not particularly proficient in 12-step slogans, language, thought patterns. And it would be phony for me to try and pretend something that isn't true. But to the extent that I can, speak in language, were I in a setting speaking to folks that are mostly 12-step folks, to understand kind of the thought patterns, the modes of speech, the things that are, if you say this, it's going to be misunderstood, it's going to be rejected. Just finding a way to speak in terms that are agreeable to the people in front of you, not phony. You know, it's not like some approaching 70-year-old guys trying to look like a teenager. That gets a little weird when you're trying to, you know, I'm really cool and I know all the latest whatever, and you make an idiot of yourself. But it's not it's a loving expression of respect for people that don't know what they're talking about yet. They don't know me, and I want to be understood. Does that make sense? You're not being something else, but you are extending yourself to be understood, to be loved. I mean, to express love. The crowd was quiet. And he said, I am a Jew, born at Tarsus in Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, educated according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, and being zealous for God as you all are this day. I persecuted this way, that is, the Christian movement, this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of elders bear me witness. From them I received letters to the brethren, and I journeyed to Damascus to take also those who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. I was raised in this city. There are people who are still here that can tell you the truth. I was educated in the best schools. I rose to positions of authority. I was given letters authorizing me to drag Christians back here for punishment and mistreatment and jail, even death. Now, this again is a further choice on Paul's part to stand next to the people who are wanting to tear him limb from limb. I'm not all different than you. I am just like you. Yeah. Yeah. I spent the early part of my life trying to tear Christians limb from limb. You're trying to do that, but I know exactly what that's like. That's what I used to do for a living. The phrase zealous for God is crucial here. I know you're doing this, as far as you understand it, for the right reasons. This isn't the worst version of you. This is not the, you know, secret addiction that you're hiding from people. You're out front about this. This is what you believe is true. The best version of you, as far as you know it, is to be zealous for God. And zealous for God means taking on the enemies of God. And I'm proud of this. I'm proud of my zeal for the glory of the God of Israel. I know exactly what that's like. I was just like you. Again, if you'd been on your way to see your uncle, you're accosted by folks who think you're something you're not, and they think you're filled with hate speech and vilification and death to fags, and that's what who they think you are, and you know you're being accused of all this stuff, to be able to say, I know that your zeal comes from a place of wanting the best for people whom you feel have been mistreated and are downtrodden and whose rights have been denied, who've been marginalized, who have And you can go on to talk about how the pride movement, as it understands itself, is a good thing. I'm doing my best for humanity. And Paul is willing to say, I know what that's like, to have a zeal that takes you in the wrong direction. But as far as you know, you're being the best version of yourself you can be. Why is granting folks, both he's standing with them, but he's also in some ways honoring what they're doing even though it's wrong. How does that help and add to his testimony, help his communication? Yeah. Now again, if it's phony, it's not useful. If I were to go to a gathering of veterans and start talking about my long service in Vietnam and all the stuff I went through, which is all lies, and I'd never been to Vietnam, and if you're trying to identify in ways that aren't true, it's worse than it's not only not useful, it's destructive. But he's telling the truth. I know what it's like to be in your shoes. To be zealous of God, to be fearful of change, to assume that those who are speaking of the Messiah that they're speaking of are undermining the great work of God. I know what's going on inside you, and I think again, he didn't have a chance to write this speech ahead of time, but it's clear that these are his convictions about people who are and. Paul, for all his life, will say that he is the chief of sinners. That if nobody had been a worse person, had been further from God, had been more unlikely to be chosen than me, and I did it thinking I was doing the best, and I was lost. And so he's helping, again, standing with people, and he's doing it with honesty, and he's telling the truth. Christians are at their worst when they're talking down to people, when they're demanding that someone else understand me and cross the bridge to my side of the bridge rather than me extending myself to you, when they don't recognize that the universal human condition is to misunderstand ourselves and need what we don't need God in ways we don't get, and yet obviously too many times Christians and churches and Christian movements and publications are filled with a sense of the foolish other and self-righteousness and so on. But there's none of that in Paul. I know exactly why you're doing what you're doing. And he's not pushing back against what they're doing. He's speaking to them in Hebrew. He's speaking to them to be understood. Well, let's move on then. And as I made my journey and drew near to Damascus, about noon a great light from heaven suddenly shone about me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And I answered, Who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me saw the light but did not hear the voice of the one who was speaking. So you're going to tell your testimony someday, maybe. You'll have a chance to tell the story of what God's done for you. Very few people have this story to tell, where God spoke from heaven, knocked you to the ground, blinded you, spoke in a voice no one but you could understand, changed everything in a moment. There are Christians who have, quote, a Damascus Road conversion, or of whom, you know, they use the phrase, I saw the light, and so on. There are Christians that, and I know some, that it was, you know, night and day, instantaneous, once here, now there kind of experience. Most of us have a bit more gradual, even if it's fairly quick. We can look at the elements that went into our becoming followers of Christ and understand it was kind of a process and so on. But whether we have a Damascus Road conversion to speak of, or we were raised in a church and wandered away and then came back later, or whether we were befriended by a Christian whose life impressed us and we began to examine the faith more, or whether we were, you know, crushed in sin and started to crawl forward and looking for the ray of light that was, or whatever. However it happened to you that you've become a person who has faith in Christ. There are some elements of this story that I think are worth noting for the day that you'll tell your story, for the occasion when someone wants to know what happened to you, when the occasion when someone is in your face maybe, or attracted to you, or how did it happen, Bruce? You weren't always this way. What happened to you? And here's some things in Paul's statements that I think are worth paying attention to. First of all, he doesn't say, I just changed my mind. Well, I used to be a pacifist, and then I got mugged, and now I carry a gun. You know, I changed my mind about, you know, something that I used to think one way, and now I think another, because of whatever. I had some life experience that you know, I used to be a liberal, now I'm a conservative, or I went through some stuff, I've learned to be there. He has not just changed his mind about something. He was apprehended by the living God. There is it's something much deeper than changing the things, the way you think about life. It's a connection to a person. However that happened, instantaneously or slowly, what makes a testimony valid and true and powerful and honoring is that it has Christ at the center, and it's about somehow, I did not know one who knew me, and I now know him. And everything is different because of that. It's not just changing your mind, Bruce.
You know, the comment you had made at the beginning about AA and how things happen in AA. When you speak at AA, there's like, when you're going to speak, you're like, what do I say? How do I do it? And what they say is you say what it was like, what happened, and what is it like now? And that's right. Basically what he's doing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Where you were, how you changed, where you are. Did any of you ever, are you tempted to think that being a Christian is just changing your mind? Do you know people that use that language that, well, I've learned to think differently about the world or something, as if that were all? Yeah. Or at least in Sunday school, he did. Right. Right. And that's part of, you know, what these Jews who are attacking him are zealous for God. And they're accusing Paul of having points of view or taking actions that they disagree with. And he's not going to sort of argue what's the best way for Jews to behave in the temple. He's not talking about, well, I could do different, or I used to think one thing, or I've changed, or, you know, what he's saying is something happened to me. I was crashed into by the living God. And whatever else you think about me, you're going to have to deal with this part of me. Is there some intervention that comes from some other place that lasts forever? And that's why I'm different. I didn't just decide to be insulting because I can get, you know, or I don't like getting beat up and, you know, I don't, you know, Dre? I can't imagine you getting in trouble, Andre. That's the other part. I mean, that almost never happens. Second thing I think that's in this story, and again, Paul's story is so unique, it's hard to make it fit to everybody. But I do think that one of the things that's in here that's interesting to me is that he only speaks of himself. There were other people around. They didn't hear they heard the voice. They didn't understand it. They saw the light but weren't blinded by it. It's what he's saying is something happened to me that, and I'm not going to put it on anyone else right now. But in my own heart and mind and reality, I had to walk forward and hear what I heard and question what it said and believe what I was told. And at some point, it has to be yours and not, well, I'm part of a club that believes these things. God spoke to me, and I'm going to have to answer ultimately for me in this. And my companions around will have their own time and place when God by the Spirit speaks to them. But this happened to me. It wasn't on them. It was on me. Then there are, in these verses, there are two. Well, I was going to move this over and put Paul in the being blinded by a light. There are two questions in the text we just looked at. One is the question that Jesus asks to Paul. Why are you persecuting me? The things you're doing are being done to me, is one of the things Jesus said. You're not acting apart from me. You're persecuting, hurting people who are me, who are mine, and therefore it's being done to me. But he doesn't phrase it as an accusation. Stop persecuting me. He says, why? Why are you doing it, Paul? Saul, I'm going to call him Paul. He's still Saul at this point. He gets his name changed later. Why are you persecuting me? Why are you doing this? And one of the great questions that God asks those who are in the spotlight for the moment is why are you doing what you're doing right now? Why are you running scared? Why are you showing off? Why are you lying to the people you love? Why are you living a life of pretense and puffery? And why are you degrading yourself? Why are you doing it again? What's going on inside you? The living God is asking this. Why am I doing the stuff that I'm doing? It hasn't worked for years. I'm still doing it again. And it's the question of sort of self-discovery. Why are you doing this? That I think most of us run from. We try not to let anybody ask it, but when the voice comes from heaven and you can't see anymore, who are you, Lord? You know, that's the second question. We'll get to that in a minute. But when you realize it's God asking the question, why are you here again? And on and on. And again, all of us have a different thing about us, whether it's, you know, we're proud, we're arrogant, we're a persecutor of others, we imagine ourselves to be the brightest light in the world, or whether we are the lowest and most miserable. Why am I the way I am? And if I can acknowledge that there's something there that's wrong, then I can let the next part of God's speech happen to me as well. Kelly, you're going to say something? Yeah.
For us to know. So we can put it right up on the front board, this is what I'm doing, and then you make your decision.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it makes me look at the reason why I chose to use that was just an underlying.
Yeah.
There's something underneath that.
Yeah.
Why I choose educating myself because there's an underlying issue, and I think that's what Jesus was asking. And God was asking
me, yeah.
What's going on with you?
Yeah. Not just what are you doing, why are you doing it? There's something there. Elsie?
Someone told me once that stuck with me that God never asks questions because he needs to know something.
Right.
He asks questions because he needs to
absolutely. Know. Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah, his questions are all, he knows the answers, but we don't, or are not yet willing to. Peter?
Does this tie back to deny yourself, God created us to rely on him, rely on others, not operate yourself?
Yeah, I think it does. What is the delusion? We're not operating the way we're made to operate. What is the chosen delusion that we're operating on? Why are we doing what we're doing? Yeah. And again, Paul's just, you know, he's not trying to say you should believe what I'm saying. This is what happened to me. At the most crucial moment, and he'll say later, we'll come to this chapters down the road here, when he gives the same testimony again. And he adds the phrase, it's hard for you. God actually said more to him than the Lord said more than it's just recorded here. It was a longer speech. And another question is, or another observation is made, is it's hard to kick against the goats. The other thing that's usually going on with most of us is we think we're zealous for God. We think we're doing the right thing. We're all in. We believe what we say about ourselves. We're charging ahead. We're putting on the best front. But there's a part of us that kind of knows, you know, I am putting good people in prison for crying out loud. I am mistreating women and children in the name of God. I don't quite feel that great about this. He watched Stephen stoned to death, and he cheered on the people that were stoning him. This beautifully good man who saw a vision of heaven, and he cheered on the violence and kind of worked on him. You know, I'm making the best of myself, but it's not completely good. I know that. And so when the why question comes, he's already partly aware, but needs to be more aware that you can't keep on the way you are, and God is forcing me, as I tell my story, God forced me to see myself the way I am. You know, and the hearer has to say, oops, maybe I'm beating up good people. Maybe I'm doing stuff. Dre, go ahead. So come to step closer and turn off the TV. No, I know. Yeah, you're right. We live in a world that's going to do everything it can to pull us away. Absolutely. That's right. No, you're right. I agree with you on that. Absolutely right. So there's another. I'm going to move this thing along here. Another aspect of what happened to Paul doesn't happen to everybody exactly this way. But here's an element that I think is universal. When people are truly changed by an action of God. Jesus asked the question, why are you doing that? Paul asked the question, who are you, Lord? And there's only one answer to that question. Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. At the end of the day, that name has to pronounce itself. We have to believe in Jesus and not just generally in religion, not just all these ways up the mountain, not good intentions. At some point, I have to bow my knee before one Lord and one Lord only. His name is Jesus, and Jesus of Nazareth in particular, an historic Messiah who was killed for me and raised for me. And Paul, again, he's blinded. He's not knowing what's going to happen next. But he knows the name that he must believe. And that's got to be, I think, part of our testimony as well. Whatever else happened to us, I had to see myself. I had to believe in Jesus. Those things, at least, at a minimum. And I'll tell you how it happened for me. My story, and it's different than your story, but it has those elements in it. Self-discovery and a knee bowed before Jesus Christ in particular. Okay, so we're going to leave this text. We started it with a cliffhanger, right? Paul jostled and mobs and Roman soldiers and shackles and, you know, what will happen? Well, let me talk to him. speaking in Hebrew. And we're going to not even finish the speech. I don't know why Stuart did this. Stuart's brilliant, I think, Stuart Van Horn. He keeps leaving us with he divided the stuff up and told, you know, different people to teach it, but he keeps leaving these cliffhangers, so you need to come back next week to hear the rest of it. But there is one more step that we'll get to today. Paul, again, he's blind, he's fallen, he's heard a voice, he's asked a question, and I said, "What shall I do, Lord?" And the Lord said to me, "Rise and go to Damascus, and there you will be told all that is appointed for you to do." And when I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. What's going to happen in Damascus? What's the next thing? Paul doesn't, he hasn't even coalesced his thinking yet. He's told to take one step, that is get up and go to Damascus. Now, but remember, the priests had given him letters to go to Damascus to beat up Christians. Now Jesus is sending him to Damascus to go learn from Christians. It's to go listen, to go subordinate himself to those who are there, to be brought into a family. And again, all this stuff is things we're going to see next week. It's clear that when Paul asks the question, "What shall I do, Lord?" the answer is, "I have a future for you." You don't know what it is yet. It'll take you a while to learn it. You'll screw it up sometimes, for sure. But I have a future for you. What you must do is now in my hands. It is what I have intended for you. And all of this, the zeal for God you used to have, your capacity for zeal is going to have a good use now. It's zeal for something that's worth being zealous for. It's all in for something that's life-giving instead of death-dealing. I have something for you to do. And that's, again, that's all we know yet. There's more, of course, we know more. We've been reading through Acts. We know a great deal. Paul's telling a story about something that happened a long time ago. He's just given the story of his experience to these, to his interrogators. But I think it's a great place for us to end today. Your testimony is important. But it doesn't end just with belief. It ends with, let's get on with it. I got something for you. A place to be, usefulness, important life to live, whether you feel like it or not, whether you think you have a contribution to make. God knows you have a contribution to make, and he intends for you and me to make it. And that's part of being changed too. We not only confess Christ, we join Christ in what he's doing. Any last questions or comments about this? Again, we're kind of waiting to see. I don't know what's going to happen, but we'll find out. Rick?
Yeah, if you were Paul, and you've been out chasing after the Christians, and then the one you've been persecuting knocks you down and blinds you and all this stuff, your expectation is you're going to get squashed.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what you expect. And instead, you have a future.
That's right. And again, he's telling this story of his own life to people who are exactly where he was when it started. And the implication is, aren't you a little bit concerned that you're beating up people who are actually good people? And do you wonder if maybe God isn't a little bit bigger than the familiar stuff you have? And so anyway, they've got all those maybe questions about themselves that they can't articulate. But even if not, he's given them a picture of something that's so much better. And I think Rick's exactly right. We're afraid that if we encounter God, that it will be terrible, that we'll be lost and stepped on and thrown aside and whatever. And yet he wants to put us into service. And I think it's a great, great vision. Someone else have something you want to say about this before we turn it over to a sharing time? Yeah, I don't know your name, sir.
Where I look.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, that's a great word. Thank you, Albert. Great word. Well, let me pray, and we'll finish kind of our, again, bated breath for next week. You can't afford not to be here next week to find out what happens, but we'll finish today. Lord Jesus, thank you for your servant Paul and for his encounter with you. Telling his story when he was threatened and telling his story to those who needed to hear it. Help us to know our story, Lord, in a way that we can offer it to someone else as a gift from you. I pray in Jesus' name.